This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This science that we're able to support and to advance is helping us understand what's going on with the health of the oceans. And it's not only something, as we're discussing this, has kind of our signature on it. It's something that is going to influence human health as well.
Oceans cover about 70% of our planet and represent over 95% of all of the Earth's water. The human impact on the ocean includes temperature rise, coral bleaching, ocean acidification, and changing chemical composition of the water. All of these things, of course, have an effect on the organisms that live in these vast ecosystems. This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a look back into the archives. First, we revisit our discussion with Jeff Bohm, the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California, as he talks about the work his organization does to protect seals up and down the Pacific coast. Then we speak with Boston Globe reporter David Abel about the surprising resurgence of Atlantic cod. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jeff Bohm. He's a veterinarian and the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California. Jeff, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, for our listeners around the country, why don't you talk about some of the good work that you and your colleagues do at the Marine Mammal Center?
Yeah, happy to do so. We are a nonprofit teaching hospital. We just happen to focus on marine mammals. We cover 600 miles of the California coastline as the range within which we'll rescue these animals. Our primary focus is getting them in, getting them well, getting them back out in the ocean. But each patient that comes our way is an opportunity to advance a really robust scientific research agenda. And some of the things that we're finding out are pretty stunning about the waters off this coast, certainly. And we educate. We talk to people about the work that we do and feel that if we can contribute to moving people towards a better understanding of their own role as good stewards of the ocean, that's a huge contribution we can make as well.
So why don't you give us an idea of the type of animals you treat? It's mostly seals and sea lions, correct?
Right. Those are all animals that are part of a group we call pinnipeds, and this is your seals and sea lions. We do respond to any marine mammal that comes up on our beaches, but more than 95% of the animals that come into our care are in fact California sea lions, harbor seals, elephant seals.
And you don't have the physical plant to be able to bring in a whale and heal that whale in your facility, correct?
Correct.
This would have to be kind of an on-site deal.
Yeah, so even some of the larger seals and sea lions, elephant seals are quite large, and we joke that we make a house call if that's the case. And we'll go out on the beaches sometimes, remotely sedate the animals, get close to them to remove a packing strap or to otherwise intervene. But you're right, very large animals, we need to go to them.
Are you the go-to hospital for Ano Nuevo down near Pescadero, north of Santa Cruz, which is one of the famous nesting grounds for elephant seals? Are you the kind of de facto hospital for this site?
We are. And so really any beach along 600 miles of coastline from Mendocino County on the far north down to San Luis Obispo County, with San Francisco being in the middle, any shoreline that an animal comes up on, we are the folks who will go there. And that spans national parks, state parks, county parks, et cetera. Ano Nuevo is this exceptional place in that it is it offers a refuge for elephant seals and others that are out on that island.
And give us a little history on the Marine Mammal Center. Before we started speaking, you said that you actually worked as a volunteer as a kid, and now you're the executive director. So it's been around for a little while.
It has. We are in our 40th year in 2015, And the transition over those 40 years has been nothing short of remarkable. Started with volunteers who wanted to do the right thing by the animals that they were seeing coming up on the coast, and has grown now to an organization of international renown. We've treated more than 20,000 animals during those 40 years. And we were started by volunteers, and volunteers are still the driving force of our work. We have more than 1,200 volunteers who help us achieve the goals of the organization.
So what years were you volunteering?
Yeah, so I grew up not far from the organization, wanted to be a veterinarian from the time I was just a youngster, and found my way out to volunteer in 1980 at the Marine Mammal Center.
So 35 years since you've been interacting with these mammals on a daily basis. Maybe you can give us a kind of a quick time lapse snapshot of how climate change and encroaching habitat has affected the patients that you treat at the center.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. 40 years ago, the organization was responding to those animals that came up on the beach, just as we are today. But when you think about the things that are impacting them now and the discussions that we're having because of what we are privileged to see by virtue of what the patients bring to us with ailments and the challenges they face, it's nothing short of stunning. I think the work of the Marine Mammal Center has never been more relevant than it is today. This year, as a case in point, we've seen more than 1,700 patients in this year alone. That in the context of having seen 20,000 in 40 years. Significant numbers of animals are coming in. And if you were to look from a percentage basis at what causes the animals to be in harm's way or to be ill, malnutrition is at the top of the list. And this year and last, warm waters off the California coast are really kind of precluding nursing females from getting the forage fish that they would need to raise their pups well.
Can you explain how that works exactly?
Sure. Off the Southern California coast, and this has been in place for a couple of years now, a warm water blob is what it's referred to in the media, has been in place. And if you're a California sea lion, for instance, you're giving birth to your pups on the Channel Islands off of the Southern California coast. And you're nursing those pups for the better part of a year, some 10, 11 months. So you're going off on these foraging expeditions to get your own nutrition. You're likely pregnant at that same time with the next pup. So your nutritional needs, your caloric needs are high. The warm water is precluding the colder, nutrient-rich waters, which are part of this amazing upwelling on the California coast. The warm waters are keeping those waters at bay. And so these females are traveling greater and greater distances to get the food that they need. They're coming back poorly nourished themselves, unable to care for their pups, sometimes aborting and losing the pup that they're carrying. And at a point, these pups are effectively orphaned, and they have left those rookeries, and this past year came up on California coast beaches to the tune of some 3,000 animals that were prematurely without their moms in really poor body condition. The primary problem being malnutrition, sometimes secondary problems like parasitism and infections as well. But this is a manifestation of things that are really changing in our ocean environment, and things that we wouldn't be talking about were it not for the fact that we were looking at each individual animal that comes into our care and trying to think about what the bigger picture is, what these animals are telling us, what window they give us into ocean health.
So you're treating more marine mammals than ever before, but do you also have an idea of their population and whether seals and sea lions are becoming more endangered, or are you just treating more of them that are ill?
We do have a good sense of the population numbers off of our coast. Certainly with the three primary species that we see, and these are California sea lions, Pacific harbor seals, and northern elephant seals with California sea lions. The numbers are up upwards of 270,000, approaching 300,000 individuals. The other two species, about 40 or 50,000 animals.
Is this just Northern California, or is this worldwide?
This is just California. And for some of these, that is their...
Like a Pacific Harbor seal. Extent. This is their region.
Yeah, yeah. So are these animals that I'm mentioning endangered? No. Is this a significant situation? Well, sure. It's been a few years now where the your class of pups, if you will, it has been hit hard, and there have been losses. As biologists who go out and look at these animals are thinking about what this means for the population. They're thinking about where that cohort will be some 3 to 5 years from now when they're of reproductive age. Might this signal some population effects? Perhaps. What's important for us, and something that we bear in mind, is whether it's an insight into the state of forage fish and the lack of them along our coastlines, or another instance, whether it's an insight into a harmful algal bloom and how that's impacting the animals, or an incidence of cancer that we see in California sea lions. These are all things that for us are not only important for the care of each and every patient that we see, but are helping us through the peer-reviewed publications that we get out, offer insights and offer avenues of research to some of our colleagues as well.
Everything went from bad to worse. Money never changed a thing. Death kept following, tracking us down. At least I heard your bluebird sing. Now somebody's got to show their hand. Time is an enemy. I know you're long gone. I guess it must be up to me. If I'd have thought about it, I never would have done it. I guess I would have let it slide. If I'd have paid attention to what others were thinking, the heart inside me would have died. But I was just too stubborn to ever be governed by enforced insanity. Someone had to reach for the rising star. I guess it was up to me.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California, Jeff Bohm. So, Jeff, give us an idea of the breakdown of quote-unquote natural causes of death and illness you see in your patients versus man-made. What percentage would you say is of your job is caused by us being around?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. There's a couple of ways I'd want to frame this. One, we do track, because we are part of a national marine mammal stranding network, and we work under the authorization of NOAA Fisheries. And data is amassed by us and our colleagues and centralized in that way. And one of the things that they look for are what the anthropogenic cases are, what the numbers are. And it's roughly 8 to 10% of the animals that come in that fall into that category. And these are animals that are impacted by ingestion of fishing hooks or entanglement in marine debris, or sadly and disturbingly, gunshot victims.
Well, couldn't even cancer be considered a man-made?
Well, there you go.
Thing, right?
So
from chemicals, right?
So while not classified that way for those purposes, I'm hard pressed, Alex, to think of any of the cases that come in that don't in some way have our fingerprints on
really?
Them. And that to put that in context, you reference cancer. Roughly 1 in 5 of the adult sea lions that come into our care. So bear in mind, these are animals that are sick for some reason, right? If they die in our care, we find have cancer, and it's the same kind of cancer. It's a urogenital carcinoma that these animals have, both males and the females. They also in their blubber are carrying around chemicals that are sometimes legacy chemicals, DDT and the likes, that have persisted in the ocean environment.
For generations, really.
For generations, right. Right. As well as contemporary things like flame retardants and others. It looks like there is a heritable aspect to this, as well as a viral component as well. But it has oncologists at local universities looking over our shoulders at this cancer cluster, if you will, and trying to assess what it means, not just for wildlife health, but for human health as well. So yeah, absolutely, you can draw a connection between that situation and human influence. If you look at a toxicity that we see, and this is something that's been in the press here on the West Coast for some time this fall, in that there is a toxin that's produced by algae. The toxin is called domoic acid, and it happens to be a mimic of a naturally occurring neurotransmitter. In California sea lions, when it's ingested, it causes seizures. That's if it's an acute situation. If it's chronically ingested, it actually causes death of neural tissue and other challenges to the animal as well. Well, this is a naturally occurring toxin, right? It's produced by algae, but those algal blooms are influenced by
temperature
effluent,
change.
Nutrients in effluent coming out of estuaries and out of rivers and streams, all of which are impacted by us. So there again, you have what on the surface sounds like a naturally occurring problem, but clearly is something that is influenced by us. So some will, and I think sometimes in a cynical way, say, well, why don't you just let nature take its course? You know, these animals are dying on the beach. There's probably some natural reason. Why do you do this work in the first place? And one of the reasons for me and for the 1,200 people who are part of this organization is it's the right thing to do. It's the humane thing to do. We can alleviate suffering, so we ought to. But this science that we're able to support and to advance is helping us understand what's going on with the health of the oceans. And it's not only something, as we're discussing this, has kind of our signature on it. It's something that is going to influence human health as well.
He's the executive director of the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California, Jeff Bohm. Jeff, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by David Abel. He's an environmental writer for the Boston Globe. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
So, you wrote a very interesting piece recently as part of a larger project following the resurgence of the cod off of the waters of Newfoundland, the Grand Banks. So what was the inspiration for following this story?
Well, cod in Newfoundland is sort of central to their culture, just as it is to the culture of New England. And as a environmental reporter for the Boston Globe, I cover the fisheries a lot, and the concerns about cod and the tradition of cod fishing is a huge part of the lifeblood of this region. It's what brought settlers to the United States. It's what financed the American Revolution. It's what really built up a lot of the wealth in this region in the early part of our history, and has sustained that for many years since then. And so I have followed the trials and tribulations of the cod fishery in the New England area, and have looked to what happened in Newfoundland as a cautionary tale, and now potentially as some promise of what could come and how long it might take for the fishery to rebound.
Let's go back 20 years before we go 200 years back. What happened to the cod stocks 2 decades ago?
Well, if you're talking about Newfoundland, the cod fishery in Newfoundland was one of the largest fisheries in the entire world. And there were major factory-style ships from Russia and from Norway and from all over Europe that used to come to fish in those waters. And they had Canada had a huge fishery of its own. And for many years, that fishery was able to sustain huge amounts of fishing, but that fishing really depleted the resource over time, to the point that environmental changes in the late 80s contributed to the problems of overfishing, and that created a cataclysm for the fishery in Newfoundland. There used to be in the 60s a catch of some 800,000 metric tons of cod, and that declined somewhat over the years, but there was a huge amount of catch in the early 80s, and the size of the fishery was substantial. Some say that the mature population of cod, which is how most scientists measure the population of fisheries, was something like 1 million metric tons. By 1992, after years of scientists cautioning fishermen and policymakers about the size of the catch, the population of cod in Newfoundland declined to something like 150,000 metric tons, and then within a few years to something like just 10,000 metric tons, an infinitesimal amount of cod compared to what was there historically. That led ultimately in 1992 to Canadian authorities deciding to declare a moratorium on all of cod fishing in Newfoundland. And that resulted in a terrible blow to their economy, resulting in the layoffs of tens of thousands of fishermen and truckers and processing plant employees and all of the people that were intimately connected with the fishing industry there. And that ban on cod fishing has been in effect for the most part since 1992.
And it seems to be working. Why don't you give us an update on where things are in terms of the cod populations?
So for years, the federal government has very aggressively enforced its ban on cod fishing. But in recent years, as the waters there have changed temperatures, and seemingly climate change has actually benefited cod in Newfoundland to some extent, the cod population in the last few years has started to rebound. And an assessment of the cod population done this past spring found that there are now something like 300,000 metric tons of cod, which is roughly double what the size of the population was estimated to be at 2 years ago. And scientists think that population is likely to double in size again in 2 years. So many scientists there think that they're watching the exponential growth of the cod fishery. And within several years, maybe 5 years, the fishery could be back to its historical size, and that might allow for a robust fishery to resume after many years of it being completely in abeyance.
And the reasons for the rebound of this fish is not so clear. It's not just that there was a moratorium. Why don't you explain maybe how the change in water temperatures may have affected the populations as well of the cod?
Sure. So in the late 1980s, for reasons that are not 100% clear to me or to scientists, the water temperatures off Newfoundland declined substantially. And many people think that that led to the dying off of the forage species, the bottom of the food chain in the waters off of Newfoundland, of a fish called capelin. It's a kind of smelt. It's a small silvery fish that brings humpback whales and cod and all kinds of fish feed on the capelin. The capelin population crashed, and that was the primary food for cod, and that, scientists say, is the most likely cause for the crash of cod. But cod also exist and thrive in a narrow band of temperatures, and so their numbers were very difficult to maintain and to increase in those waters and without their primary food species. But as the waters have warmed in recent years, primarily due to climate change, the waters have made it more amenable for fish like capelin and cod to rebound, and that's what we're seeing now.
So the warming waters allowed capelin, one of the cod's main foods, to rebound, and thus cod stocks started to climb as well off of Newfoundland. Was this a global population that we're examining, or is the snapshot of Newfoundland unique only to that fishing zone?
Right. Well, fisheries are really distinct for the regions that they're in.
Maybe first you could define what a fishery is.
Sure. Okay. So each region has its own population of a species of fish. And so they rise and fall based on the environmental conditions that they live in. So there are species of fish that migrate across the oceans, and you can't say the same things about them, like whales, for example. But for fish like cod that stay relatively close to their spawning grounds, their migration is a lot smaller, and so their health, their viability as a species, as a stock, depends on their environment. And if their environment changes substantially, whether it's due to pressure from fishing, whether it's due to the temperature of waters, whether it's due to the acidity of waters, that has a great impact on their ability to thrive. And we saw direct impacts, and we've seen direct impacts to fisheries all around the world as environments change, but we're seeing that very clearly in New England with cod here, as well as cod in Newfoundland.
Boston Globe reporter David Abel, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Grant Green, Bob Dylan, and Derek and the Dominoes. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.